This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Maui County has had the weekend to exhale after a contentious council meeting over what to do about a lawsuit pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. On a 5-4 vote, the council opted to settle the suit rather than leaving open the chance that the high court could weaken environmental protections in place now. But what will the mayor do? We talked to County Council Chair Kelly King this morning about what happens now.
The council exercised our powers. And, there is a section in the county council, and I quoted that on my Facebook page, section 2.2, exercise of powers. It says all powers of the county shall be carried into execution as provided by this charter, or if the charter makes no provisions, as provided by ordinance or resolution of the county council. So what that means is that because the charter is vague on these kinds of instances and who has the ultimate authority, that the council can by ordinance exercise its power of ultimate authority, which is what we did. We passed a resolution to settle the case and remove it from the Supreme Court, and that's what we expect the court counsel to follow through on, and as well as our special counsel, who was hired by powers of the council.
So are there any meetings taking place today between the appropriate parties on going forward?
I haven't gotten into the office yet, but I will be meeting, personally, when I do get into the office, with our council, our Office of Council Services Legal Authority, and just to go over what the next steps would be, because we, really it should be up to corp counsel to just follow through. And one of the problems with our charter is that it sets up the corp counsel to serve both the mayor and the county council. So they're in a, in a sticky situation where the mayor wants to go one way, but the fact that the council has passed this resolution at the full council meeting, it should give them clear direction. And if it doesn't, there could be some implications of, and I've heard people talk about possible constitutional crisis. It could be lead to an injunction, but I'm hoping it doesn't come to that. I'm hoping that the administration recognizes this is the will of the council and therefore the will of the people. One of my big problems with this whole case and the way it's gone over the past few years is it's really set up the county of Maui against the people of Maui. And I don't like that fact that we seem to be representing a Trump administration position against the environment that will affect the entire country. And I think people have seen that for a while now. I spoke out to our leadership last term as a council member about, settling this. Like, why aren't we meeting with the plaintiffs and trying to settle this and work on a solution instead of going to court? Because I think we all want the same things in the end. And I was just summarily shut down on that idea. So it was, I was in the minority last term, and I just didn't have a voice, really, as far as pushing this issue through to settlement.
And I know some believe this is a home rule issue.
It's interesting that that home rule issue has been used on both sides of the argument, because we could take back our power and do home rule by just focusing on the solutions. And the solutions are in front of us. Everyone keeps talking about reuse. The mayor has made a commitment to reuse and retreatment. Nobody wants outfalls. Everybody understands that that we need to do more exploratory on technology, but people have come forward with various types of technology that don't cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And so if we focus on that and we work together, I have complete confidence that we can get it done. If the administration continues to fight the council and the people of Maui, we've had just overwhelming testimony, both written and in person, of people just saying, why can't we just settle this? We know, I don't think anybody on Maui wants to pollute the ocean. So why are we going to the Supreme Court for the right to do that through our groundwater? People just don't understand it, and they don't support that. So I'm pleased with the outcome that I think we can focus hopefully on the solutions once we get this off the Supreme Court docket.
And we do have that clock ticking. There are concerns that if there's a delay in any more legal wrangling, that it's just going to get decided?
Well, no, the Supreme Court doesn't make decisions that quickly. And there is still, even if they have the hearing, which our special counsel has unfortunately given one-third of our half hour that we're allotted for arguments to the Trump administration. So that's another kind of nail in the coffin of the question of, are you working with the Trump administration to derail another environmental regulation? But, I've been speaking with lawyers in the county, and everyone agrees, and people who've been to the Supreme Court, that even beyond the Supreme Court hearing, there's still time to take it off of their agenda. It takes months for them to come to a decision about something like this. So I don't think we're necessarily under that November 6th deadline, but I do think that we need to settle this for the good of the people. We need to settle this as quickly as possible so that, I mean, there's a lot of anxiety about this. And it's unfortunate that it's set up the administration versus the people of Maui, because people are just not understanding why engineers in our Department of Environmental Management don't understand the environmental implications and keep saying that there's no other solution but to go to the Supreme Court. It's really bringing people who should be ministerial and administrative into the realm of politics. And I don't think that's healthy for anybody.
When would you like to see the two sides sit down and really tackle this?
Well, I really don't see it as being two sides right now. You know, I think right now the council has made a decision. To me, the decision is final. If the mayor takes issue with that and feels like he has a position where he can foil the council's intentions, then hopefully he would give me a call and we could talk about it then. But I haven't heard that from him. I've seen his comments in the paper that he's exploring all his options, and I'm just hoping that he will, come to a collaborative decision.
Okay, but no word yet this morning.
No, and I understand, I was hearing over the weekend that he was going to be gone Monday for 3 days. So, this is a really important thing that probably, if he thinks he has an option, he should exercise like today or this week at least. And apparently he's left Maui again. Basically, what I've been doing in my research and, discussing with lawyers, researching ordinances and the charter, is ascertaining that, yes, the council does have the power to resolve this by resolution, regardless of what the mayor decides to do, and that Corp Counsel's obligation is to now act on behalf of the council, settle the case with the plaintiff, and withdraw the case from the Supreme Court.
Mayor Victorino's office released a statement overnight. The mayor writes, from homeowners with cesspools or septic systems to hundreds of millions of dollars in treatment plant conversions with questionable environmental benefits, the effect this case could have on our residents is enormous. These issues are not scare tactics or fake news. These are very real concerns that I must fully vet in considering whether to withdraw from Supreme Court review. The soonest that Councilmember King thinks that there could be a meeting between all the parties would be at the end of the week. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're remembering a Japanese American who played a dangerous double game as a member of the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps during the Second World War. This Hawaii-born Nisei was originally recruited in Manila in the months before the war. Initially, his task was to keep track of Japan's activities in the Philippines. After war broke out, he became a translator and an undercover agent, interrogating captured POWs and retraining new recruits in Japanese language skills. Much of his story was preserved in his own words through journals and poems that he left behind, told in the book Reflections of Honor, The Untold Story of a Nisei Spy. For today's quiz, we want to know the name of this secret agent. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation supporting the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting Steel and Concrete, the Modernization of Tokyo Architecture in Woodblock Prints through November 17th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Before Dolly the Sheep, Dewey the deer, and Cece the cat, there was Kumulina, the world's first clone mouse. Next week, October 3rd, marks the birthday of the Manoa mouse. Kumulina lived for 2.5 years, the mouse equivalent of 90 human years. She was created back in 1997 in Yana's lab. Ryuzu Yanigamachi is a scientist who himself is 91 years old and who still reports to work at the University of Hawaii. The fruits of his labor put the Honolulu technique on the map. Other breakthroughs include making mice glow in the dark by using bioluminescence from jellyfish. The Biogenesis Institute, named in Yana's honor, recently snagged another $5 million to continue related research. We invited Yana, Professor Stefan Moisati, who is part of the Institute research team, and Steve Ward, who has shepherded the research center since its creation. Ward puts it in perspective.
Over the last 20 years, the IBR has really been quite successful. We've brought in about $60 million in grants funding since that day through all our groups. We have 10 years of funding of a center grant called the Center of Biomedical Research Excellence from the NIH. So this is a federally funded program. I like to point out that we got two grants. Each one of those were about, the first one was about $10 million, the second was $11 million. And the new one we just got is $5 million. So these are 15 years of funding for the entire center, for the entire group of 14 scientists now who are working in the field of what Yana started with originally, with 40 years of work before Kumulina, which is what he was really recognized for. So the institute that he founded has really blossomed and grown incredibly since, you know, that time.
So, Stefan, can you talk about what kinds of projects that the lab will be doing?
Sure. We usually kind of provide a service for the UH researchers for any transgenic animals that they want. So that is us. We will do any transgenics they want. Then we do CRISPR work, which is the latest technology that everybody's interested in. And I personally have a project that has to do with cancer immunotherapy and also cholesterol reduction in the blood. And they're both doing well. It's just securing the funding for them that is an issue for me at the moment. But transgenic-wise, we're set. We got another 5 years of funding, and we'll be able to make any animal that anybody in Hawaii needs for them at a reasonable price.
Now, I recall, Yana, this whole thing came out of the research you were doing about fertility, right?
Yes. Yeah. I've been interested in fertility. I work with mice and human too. And my main interest is still a process of fertilization. Fertilization is the life starting point. Everything, even ourselves, started at time fertilization. I'm a basic scientist who are interested in analyzing every process of the fertilization. And I have some unfinished business myself, and I work myself. And luckily, I have many of my postdocs abroad who get their own lab now. So I visit them from time to time. And like a King's experiment, 90% work done by young people. I just work 10%. I watch microscope and give advice and paper, write the paper together, something like that.
Many people in Hawaii don't know that Yana was actually involved with the two scientists who developed the first IVF baby in 1978. So he's been around for a long time and has been a clear leader in fertility of all kinds for 40 or 50 years. He invented some of the techniques that are used now to create millions of babies for infertile couples, you know, two in particular, the IVF and ICSI, that he developed in his laboratory. So Hawaii has been involved in some of the development of these fertility treatments worldwide, okay? The other point that I'd like to make is that, you know, Stefan talked about his two projects, but we've got 14 faculty, all of whom have two or three projects that are working on. So we've done a lot of interesting work so that there's a lot more than just, you know, the green mice and the cloning that it's built up over the last 20 years.
Well, I mean, it was a breakthrough because, you know, after that we got Dolly and and then all the other mammals that have been cloned since then, horses, cats.
Yep. So the reason that Jana is so famous for cloning his work is that when Dolly was cloned, she was the first mammal that was ever cloned. Nobody actually were sure that it could be done. But what this meant is that every gene in the body carries enough DNA to make everything. So your skin cells could make a brain if they wanted to. What Jana's work and his colleagues, Wakayama, showed is that they could clone. So Dolly was one sheep out of 273, I think it was. Jana cloned 50 mice, and he cloned clones of clones. So he really established the principle, and they used a slightly different technique. One of the techniques that they had used earlier where they actually inject the genetic material into the egg instead of just electrofusing it. So this became known as the Honolulu technique. And this is why, you know, his lab was established as this. And it was that 40-year experience in fertility that went before that cloning that put the strength of the discovery behind it, right? So Jana had laid the foundation out of 40 years of work before he published that work. So they knew it came from Jana's lab. This is the real thing. So those two things are what put Hawaii on the map. That's why the Institute, you know, was developed, because the Hawaii community realized that this is something that they want to continue.
Right. And Stefan, you talked about the CRISPR gene, and I know that's also a credit to another scientist from Hawaii, HILO, Jennifer Doudna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if I can add to what Steve just said, if it wasn't for Jana, maybe somebody else would have done it, but Jana established the IVF techniques that led to all the IVF clinics around the world. If Jana had not done his job at the time that he did it, maybe it would have been delayed by several years. Somebody would have got there. But Jana, without Jana, there is no IVF as we know it today, basically.
Actually, the cloning is a product, my byproduct of my basic study.
Right, you didn't set out to clone. No. You were looking at fertility.
That's right. This is my big interest. And this cloning, what's important cloning is that they tell us that all our body cell has the potential to develop other type of cell. The cloning is just making another baby. So implication of this finding is that two meaning. One is we can multiply animal or human without germ cell, but same time we can convert our body cell into other type of cell.
It's amazing. It's the sizzle that gets the attention, you know. Jana's got 40 years of work before cloning, and he was well known in the field, but the hoopla happened when Cumulina was cloned. Suddenly, the mice were being interviewed in the lab. You know, I mean, people were coming all over the place, wanted to work and talk with Jana. And like Jana says, cloning was a byproduct that Teruhiko Wakayama was interested in cloning, and he thought he could apply our techniques opposite to what they had done with Dolly, and make it succeed. And he did. And he got all the hoopla, you know? But the real work was the reproductive biology work that went on before that.
Right. And know? So where is Teru today? Where is Teru today?
He's a professor of a university, and he's still continuing cloning work.
Okay.
He's in Japan, basically.
In Japan now. Okay. And so, so today in our labs, we've then got still have the clones of the clones?
Cloning is a technique. I mean, mice don't live very long. They live two years or something. And we don't do mice just to do mice, mm-hmm. right? So if we need to work cloning to ask another experiment, we do it.
We do it one at the moment, actually.
Right. But mm-hmm. we've recently been asked by a group in Florida if we could help them clone mice, you know? So this is what we do. So, but we also have a lot of other questions related to fertility, related to developmental biology, even cancer research that can spin out of this. And since we've got, you know, 14 different faculty, you know, we can do all these things. And I'd just like to point out that, we try to give to the community as well. I mean, the money that we bring in, 80% of it goes back to the Hawaii community in the form of salaries or some direct support for
rent,
the university.
Rent.
So people use our, the federal funds that we bring in to pay their rent, to go to Safeway, et cetera. So, we are trying to give something back to the community as well. Supporting the research helps the community.
As an interesting sideline, two of our researchers just received another Center of Excellence grant with Kuakini in collaboration with UH, and there is another potential $30 million, rather, I should say, money to come to Hawaii. They just got the money, the first round this year, and that has a potential of going for another 15 years. So our people are involved with that as well. So we're doing whatever we can to stay alive. I realize that in Hawaii, academic issues are not at the forefront. And we kind of keep plugging away, keep improving things, come up with new techniques. And I'm not ungrateful. We get the rewards. I mean, we got a new building. The money's coming in. The money, local money, to support this kind of work is not here in Hawaii. In most mainland places, they have huge endowment funds as universities, and there is donors that write big checks. In Hawaii, hardly anybody writes a big check to the University of Hawaii. Most people have gone to USC or to Berkeley or somewhere in the East Coast, and that's where the checks get written. So it's a problem for generating funds by other means other than the NIH. But we're grateful. We live in Hawaii. We're happy about that. Jana loves Hawaii. He's never thought of leaving once he started here. And I feel the same way myself. Steve is committed. So we have the commitment. A lot of researchers come to Hawaii, stay 2 or 3 years, get another offer somewhere else, and they're gone. We're not going anywhere. We're here, and we're going to see it through. And then we bring in along the next generation of scientists that are also committed, and they will stay here. So we're hoping for the best. We hope we can keep this going. But it's hard work.
Yeah. And Jana, I recall interviewing in your lab when you announced the breakthrough, and we saw the green mice, and it was a big deal. But I think what struck me was that you were able to do all this solid science, basic science, in very humble circumstances. It wasn't a flashy lab. It was an auxiliary building.
The labs stink.
I'm telling the young people that most important assets in your lab is not most expensive instrument. It's your brain. And we can dream. So far, machine cannot dream. Yeah, this is my policy. So there are many interesting ideas come up. To dream is free, and a computer cannot dream. And so this is what I'm talking about, the people, young people.
Let me add to that one, that Jana most probably publishes more at this age than most of us. He has more publications coming out than the rest of us. You do get a lot of publications still, So he's not, although he's been emeritus now for over 10 years, I think.
14 years.
He still comes to the lab every day, and that includes Saturday and Sunday. I mean, you won't see me there on Saturday and Sunday. I'm burned out. I got to take a day off. Jana is there, and he's there till whatever time he goes home. And that's the dedication he takes to do this kind of breakthrough science.
Right, the dedication.
Yes.
And then just the love for science, I guess.
Yes. Jana is a devoted science kind of groupie, or whatever you want to call it, but he's a scientist through and through. You won't see him. Actually, people should come and visit our lab and just meet him and shake his hand and have a photo taken, because they're not going to meet many good scientists like this ever in their life.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. So the invitation is out there.
Yes, they're welcome to come, and I will press the button and take the photo. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you all for being here today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank
you very much.
And so we shine the spotlight on the decades of groundbreaking research work on fertility and cloning at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Hats off to Jana and Teru Wakayama and the 14-member team at the Biogenesis Research Institute. So what happened to Kumulina? Well, she's been preserved, and Ward hopes to someday secure her a place of honor at the Smithsonian Institute. We were just talking about green mice, but our reality check today looks at getting our arms around green jobs. Honolulu Civil Beats business reporter Stuart Yurton joins us from their Kaimuki studios. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So this story struck me. So we don't have good numbers about green jobs. That's interesting.
Yeah, we don't know for sure. And part of the problem is we've had this explosion of jobs. And the government agencies and entities that track these things really haven't caught up with the technology, not only here, but nationally as well.
So our best data is from where and when?
Yeah, so it looks like the best numbers that we can see are probably from a Department of Energy study. They did a really in-depth analysis. They called people. They did like telephone surveys and reached out. And to give you an example of the order of magnitude of difference that we see, this study was in 2017. DOE estimated almost 5,000 jobs in solar electricity here in Hawaii. The problem is when you look at Bureau of Labor Statistics jobs in the same sector, and this is the more up-to-date numbers, we get more like 120 jobs. So there's a huge difference. The BLS people, and again, they're normally really great authorities on all kinds of jobs data. They said, yeah, the DOE study's probably better. But again, that one's 2 years old.
Well, so, you know, why can't our Labor Department track it, or our business Department of Business and Economic Development? Why can't they track those things?
Well, the problem is that we have this industry, and they're doing all kinds of things. In, say, solar, you have electricians that are doing solar work, and maybe they're construction workers doing things, building things. We've got all kinds, lawyers doing regulatory work, all this different work going on. And no one really drills down to figure out, well, are those people working in the renewable space? And remember, this is a huge market. The government's created this demand for renewable energy with our policy, and it's important for policymakers to understand, well, what are the jobs being created, where are they, and how can we create other policies to leverage that and get the biggest bang for the buck from this policy that we have.
So what's it going to take in order to get better data?
Well, the Department of Energy study, they did surveys. So it was time consuming and very in-depth. And it seems like that's what it would take, would be more work like that. The other thing that could happen is the Bureau of Labor Statistics could create more detailed industry classification codes. That's what they use to track these jobs. So it's possible that it's called the North American Industry Classification System, that those codes could be updated eventually over time to really capture these jobs so that they would be almost reported and tracked automatically. But unless that happens, it's going to be really hard to track these things.
Yeah, and if it's a matter of manpower on the state level, it is a bit of a head scratcher, because you're thinking we have these very ambitious green goals, but we don't have really good data. It's kind of like the ag department, right? I mean, the governor wants us to be self-sufficient and raise all our food, but we really don't have a good number on our farms. It's a bit of a disconnect.
That's right, Catherine, definitely. And again, it's just going to take some time to figure this out. In the meantime, you know, legislators naturally want to ask, well, how many jobs has this created? And the short answer is, we don't know exactly how many for sure.
Yeah, not a good answer. Somebody better hurry up and start bean counting. All right. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's reality check. To read his story on this issue, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, dedicating this message of thanks to all the donors, volunteers, and staff who help to improve the health of those affected by kidney disease. KidneyHI.org.
This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's time to check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe surrounding our tiny planet, also what we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips, who we happen to have on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have in store for us this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. So this week's stargazers, the giant planets of Jupiter and Saturn, continue to grace us with their presence in the evening sky. Both planets can be seen towards the southwest after sunset. The moon this week is a mere waning crescent, and this is great news for those of us looking to spot the Hubble Space Telescope, which will be making a pass over the islands at 8 p.m. on Thursday. It will be moving from the west-southwest to the southwest, so look for a moving point of light.
And don't be alarmed, because it's not aliens, is what you're trying to say.
Absolutely not.
And then another thing, speaking of the Hubble, which we haven't heard about in a while, you've also got another return guest, I guess you could say, on Stargazer that we haven't heard about in quite some time, the Tabby Star.
Yeah, which we covered about, I think it was a year ago now. Tabby's star is a red dwarf star that has become known for its periods of irregular dimming, which have led to all sorts of theories as to what is responsible. These theories include swarms of comets, destroyed planets, and even orbiting extraterrestrial megastructures. What set Tabby's star apart from all other observed stars was the fact that it was unique. However, this may no longer be the case. Astronomers have now identified at least 21 other stars that are exhibiting bizarre dimming events.
And what do you think, Christopher, could be causing this if it's not unique?
The mysterious dimming we are seeing is looking more and more like it's the result of intrinsic activity within the star itself. Perhaps some sort of process occurring in the stellar atmosphere or irregular variations in the star.
I bet most people did not think you were going to say it's extraterrestrial megastructures.
I would love to have said that.
And they're definitely not planets, huh?
That's right, yeah. Planetary transits, as they are known, are fairly easy to identify with some statistical wizardry, as are regular variations that we see with variable stars. However, when it comes to this type of dimming, and the dimming we're seeing in other stars, it would most likely point to the star itself being the culprit.
Another fascinating and enlightening Stargazer report. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer, which can also be found at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we were looking for the name of a man who served in the U.S. Army's Counterintelligence Corps during the Second World War. He was always close to the action, returning to the Philippines with General Douglas MacArthur when he retook the archipelago and observing the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay in 1945. His story has been preserved in the book Reflections of Honor, The Untold Story of a Nisei Spy, a collection of his journals and his poetry. He wrote, "When the war broke out, I had myself placed in internment in Manila together with the Japanese people in order to seek information concerning the war capability and plans of the enemy. In spite of the danger, I stuck to my undercover role until I was relieved of that assignment and delivered from internment about a week after the outbreak of war." This secret agent's name was Arthur Komori, and his service earned him a Bronze Star. After the war, he became an attorney and served as a district court judge. But no one got that today. That's our quiz. If you have an idea, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, earlier we talked about the birthday of a famous clone mouse, but this month happens to mark the 10th anniversary of the home of a collection of Hawaii's moving images. Everything from news stories from KGMB, KHON, and KITV to film clips from Bishop Museum's treasured archives. Do you recall this bit of real history with entertainer Don Ho?
Gentlemen, the Singer Company proudly presents Hawaii Ho, starring Don Ho.
I guess you know we've just landed on one of the loveliest fleet of islands anchored on any.
You know, we talked to Heather Juni, who founded the Digital Archives in honor of her father, Henry Juni, who served as a right-hand man for Senator Dan Inouye and who also became the U.S. Senate Sergeant of Arms in our nation's capital.
My father passed away in 2005. The senator's office, particularly Pat DeLeon, came to me and wanted to do something special in honor of my father. And that's when it came to me that one of the things that filmmakers were struggling with in Hawaii was a place for their tapes to end up. And when you're a young filmmaker, you don't think about these things. All you think about is creating your project and then think about which film festival you're going to get it into. You don't think about the raw footage or where the product is going to end up. And when I was a young filmmaker, I have to say that it was librarians that would seek us out and ask us for VHS copies or 3/4-inch copies of our work. And I never really understood it at that time of what they wanted it for, but they wanted it to preserve. They were trying to preserve television history, filmic history, cinematic history of Hawaii at that time. And unfortunately, they didn't have the support, I guess, for lack of a better description, to create an archive. And as time passed, people get older. There are different groups of filmmakers and archivists and librarians that would gather to try to figure out a way to make this happen. And it eventually did by 2006-07 when we started writing legislation for it. And then 2009, we got our first funding. And the name stuck. I stuck with it. I'm very happy at the outcome of this facility. It houses all the filmmakers' works as well as institutional work as well. And what we do here and what staff does here is preserve and maintain a moving image history of Hawaii, which is a primary educational resource. We have well over 50,000 media pieces that we are taking care of in our climate-controlled facility here at UH West Oahu. I would love to have everything digitized and available so that we could today start identifying who is in all those films and videos. Because right now, the footage that we have from the 20s and 30s, and I'd say 40s as well, we can't really identify them because the people have passed on, generation have passed on, that we're now just looking at and in awe of. But we can't talk about the details of it, which is unfortunate. So I'm hoping that the boomer generation can spend some time identifying all the things that are on the footage now. And that is my hope for the future, is that we identify it, because by identifying it, by telling the stories behind those moments, just increases the value of the curriculum that will be used within the school system or with through research or however it can and will be used. I have to say that I feel very blessed because this archive, Ulu'ulu, focuses just on analog film and video. We're very exclusive that way. We do have some digital formats, but we really want to focus on digitizing everything we can on film and video before we move into the digitizing world. Most of the staff have graduated from the University of Hawaii and gotten their master's in library sciences, and they practice what they've studied. And what they've studied is best practices, and that doesn't mean hurry up and rush. It means just the opposite. It means taking your time, making sure that the tapes are clean, that the mold is clean, that there are no bugs, and that if there is a problem with one of the films, that it gets sent to the continent so that somebody who's a professional in that particular field can clean it up and deliver it to us in a digital format. We definitely do some digitization here in our facility, but the bulk of it, I have to say, goes to the mainland, and I think that's money well spent in that direction. And I'll just give you a quick reason why I say that is because originally when we first were creating this, I wanted to have it to become a work development program and have all the digitization come here. But that means that all this equipment would have to land here. And then where would we get the technicians from? And then we'd have to support the technicians that had to support the old equipment. And then the software that we were using to run the equipment from Austria or wherever it is, it was so expensive to like maintain or time consuming that staff was on the phone, you know, talking to technicians to fix something. So it's much better to split the grant money that we're fortunate to get and to be able to send a chunk of the media to a vendor, a trusted vendor in California or Georgia or wherever we go to and we use, that our money is better spent that way. But again, we do definitely do some digitization here. It's definitely it's a facility that takes money to run. Obviously, we have staff, and we have a process of digitizing the equipment. We have air conditioning to pay for. I mean, there's a climate control facility, and also we do backup, and the backup costs money too. You know, just to store our media isn't free. I mean, even as a home personal computer, if you have gigabytes, you have to store it in the cloud, you have to pay somebody. It's the same thing what we have here. The main thing is what we're trying to do is we're trying to collect everyone's footage now, okay? So I go out and I say, and because of where I am in my life, I know who most of the shooters were, most of the people that created content. I know them personally, so I would go out and strongly suggest that they donate their collection to Ulu'ulu. But that donate didn't mean that they were giving up their copyright. That's the beauty of this facility, is we're not asking for the copyright. If you don't want to give it to us, you can keep the copyright, because that's a headache if somebody wants to do commercial stuff with your property. So, but what we care about is preserving history, beautiful history that people have forgotten. You know, there are generations that have grown up here that have never seen sugarcane fields, you know, or different types of activity that no longer exist anymore. I mean, history is important. Remembering the past is important. It's important because you know what happened in the past, and you know, hopefully, how to do the future better. So this information that we have here, this collective memory that people had the wherewithal to capture on different types of equipment, is a treasure for Hawaii and an exceptional gift for Hawaii and the world to see. And we not only collect footage from inside Hawaii, but we also collect it from outside, because there are lots of expats or people that were flying through here that took and collected beautiful film footage. And it's always interesting to see it from a different perspective, to see it from a different ethnic group, and to see it from a outsider and what they take pictures of.
That was Heather Juni, founder of the Ulu'ulu Digital Archives. Head archivist Janelle Kirante had this to share about the growing collection.
So on a typical day, we are touching film, we are going through boxes, we're opening cans and videotape cases just to see what we have in a collection, make plans to get it cleaned and safely rehoused if needed so that we could store it in our vault for safe long-term storage, and then start making plans to digitize it for both preservation and access. Each collection tells a story, I think, and not just the story of who appears on the film or the video, but sometimes also a story of the filmmaker. For example, one collection that was very unique came from Molokai, from a filmmaker named Michael Dooley, who recorded a series of oral histories in the 1970s with Kupuna on Molokai. And so these stories, or these oral histories recorded in the 1970s, were recorded on a format called half-inch open-reel videotape, which was a really, really early form of portable videotape that a lot of video artists and documentarians were able to take into the field for the first time and do video recordings. And these reels had been, you know, in his home in a non-air-conditioned environment and for over 40 years, and he wasn't sure that they were even going to be salvageable or playable after all this time. And so we worked with them to bring them over from Molokai. It was about 100 reels, and they were dirty, they were moldy, they were not in the best physical shape, but we worked with the lab and they were amazing, and they're online now. so it's a whole series of interviews with these kupuna from Molokai that we were able to digitize successfully and make available through our website. And now the filmmaker, one reason why he recorded these oral histories in the first place was because as a young man, he told me the story that he really needed the wisdom of these people to help him through a tough patch in his own life. And now hearing their voices again after 40, 45 years, he's now passing on their knowledge to a new generation of young people on Molokai, hoping that their stories will also help them as they helped him as a young filmmaker.
When I walked through here and I saw on one of the screens that you have in the entryway, it was the George Cabral Senior and Junior Collection. And George Cabral Jr. worked at KHON, George Cabral Sr. worked at KITV, and I worked with him as they were making that transition from film to videotape. So I, on a personal level, I'm just thrilled that some of that has been saved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, that happens a lot at television stations where as the technology changes from one form to the other, you know, to make room for the newest equipment, the newest formats. Sometimes that older stuff gets kind of tucked away and discarded, you know, not for any malicious, you know, intent or anything like that. It's just because it's
they need room,
they need to, you know, upgrade to the newest technology. And so when Uluulu started, it was actually at a good time when stations here in Hawaii were transitioning from their analog broadcast capability to digital broadcast. And so they were trying to find solutions. What were they going to do with all of their analog tape libraries? And so Uluulu was able to come in and say, hey, you know, we can be a solution. You can come work with us. And we're starting this new archive that can handle these old formats. One success story was working with a film reel from the 1930s, I think, from Hawaiian Electric. And it was footage. It was a film reel that documented the installation of a power line and a power pole in downtown Hilo. And so the reel itself, the original reel, was about 2,000 feet. So like imagine a huge like platter or a large film reel. And it was one of those cases where just touching the film, it just crumbled. And but working with the archivist at HICO, she said, no, let's try. Let's send it to a lab and see if they can save any of it, because I think this is going to be really precious stuff. So we did. We sent it to a lab on the East Coast, and what they had to do was kind of unwind it enough to get to that central core of film, So out of that 2,000 feet, there was about 400 feet in the middle of the reel that was salvageable. And so they did. They were able to salvage it. They digitized it, and you know, it was about maybe 3 minutes of footage of downtown Hilo, 1920s, 1930s, and they are installing the electric pole.
One of the earliest.
Yeah. So that was an awesome success story.
And as we mentioned, a key part of saving the moving images is identifying the people in the film clips. The staff would like to hear from folks in the community who can help provide context. You think you could help? Well, the Ulu'ulu Digital Archives is located within the library at the University of Hawaii West Oahu campus.
Foodland's Give Aloha program makes it easy to donate to your favorite charity, and it matches your gift. Shop at any Foodland, Sack and Save, and Foodland Farm stores this month, and designate Hawaii Public Radio at checkout. Your donation helps to sustain our statewide public service, and along with your groceries, you'll take home our big mahalo.
We do have to go now, but up tomorrow, there'll be a call-in show as we talk about CBD and the state's efforts to rein in sales on the street. We would like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, just head to our conversation page on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.